Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. I am so excited to share my interview with author Naomi Jackson. She shares an amazing story of the time that she quit the job that she loved, the job that paid her well, that gave her incredible access, in order to finally commit to finishing and then publishing her first novel. There's so much wisdom that she shares throughout this interview, from the importance of libraries and museums and public institutions around the arts and how critical they were in her life and I think in all of our lives, to the importance of what it means to have a community around you and your writing, to be a part of a community of writers, and how so many good things come from that, to her decision-making process, honestly, throughout her life, to committing to her writing. And she shares just an incredible story about what it meant to become a writer, that she did not have to become someone else, that it was very much about just being who she was. And there are just so many topics here that blew me away. I was so excited to chat with her, and I feel like it's an honor to be able to share her interview with you. This is Naomi Jackson. Hey, everyone. This is Dan Blank. I'm excited to be chatting with Naomi Jackson. Welcome.
Thanks, Dan.
Been a couple years since we last connected, but I sort of thought that we would start at the beginning, because to me it feels like it ties in so much to obviously who you are, but also what you write about. And I guess the sort of easiest place to start is just, when did you first become exposed to or even embrace the idea of creativity, whether it was writing or whether it was something else entirely?
Well, I had, you know, my mother was somebody who was like really committed to her girls, realizing their potential, right? And so she, I think, might say that she was a frustrated writer, but she poured a lot into us as kids, especially when we were very little. So, you know, we were always taking classes and painting at the Brooklyn Museum and spent a lot of time at the Brooklyn Public Library. And she used to write children's books for us. And then when we got older, it was command that like every summer we would write book reports on books. So books and creativity in general were like a very strong part of my early childhood. And I like can distinctly remember like the before and after of like once I had my own library card, like that felt like in a way more important than getting a driver's license. Like for me, that was the moment when I became a grown-up, was like once I had a library card, because for me, having the access to a world of books where I could, you know, take out a book for myself was like the most important part of my childhood.
You know, it's funny, as you say that, I'm almost reminded too of a different but similar feeling of the library in general, but then that card was you can do anything.
Yeah.
Usually be more like my mom would give me her card.
Yes.
And as a child, that's a very unusual experience.
Yeah. I think there was a book that was called like Rosa Gets a Library Card. And I think my mother made me read that book so I could like understand the responsibility of having a library card. And then I was able to go, you know, sign my name and get one. I think I was like 5 or 6.
This feels like something too that's inherent of growing up in a place like Brooklyn, which is, you know, crowded, but you have access that, you know, the first response was really these essentially public institutions, these museums and these libraries, and how these can be amazing resources if you have family or you are already tuned to embracing them. It's kind of amazing to think of how that was the place to start for you.
Yeah, I mean, even the public television was a big part of my life as a young person. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, and I think like Brooklyn was our domain, but the city felt very forbidding. I think that's like kind of the funny thing, like if someone's not from New York, it's not readily apparent that you could grow up in Brooklyn and not feel like you're entirely part of New York City. So I only really felt like I had access to the whole city when I went to prep school as a high school student. Then I felt like the rest of the city opened up to me. But all those institutions really opened up the possibility and the world of art to me. So I felt like my brain was just expanded by all these public institutions. And one of the most incredible parts of my career has actually been, you know, I taped a podcast for the Brooklyn Public Library, actually, about Paul Marshall's life. She's a writer from Barbados. Well, with her family's roots were in Barbados, but she grew up in Brooklyn. And we went by Paul Marshall's house. And that felt like oddly like one of the most satisfying moments in my career to be able to interface as an actual author with the Brooklyn Public Library. For whatever reason, I'm not really big into like awards and things like that. Like those are always really wonderful. But to me, to be able to kind of contribute to an institution that helped raise me as a reader and as a writer, that actually means more to me than money or awards.
Yeah. So what were the books like that your mom created, and what was it within her that did that? Because that alone already feels like something where that's unusual. A lot of people just in general, I don't know. I don't see them having that access to the idea of like, I have a story, I'm going to write it. I don't know if she illustrated it. Did she staple it? Like what brought that on?
Yeah. And she also sewed dolls, like black dolls. She was very committed to us having, you know, this was the early 80s. I was born in 1980. And so there weren't a lot of black dolls. And she was like, okay, well, I'm going to just make them for you. Right. And so she was a very self-possessed kind of person. And so I, you know, as I'm saying the story, I was like, well, I guess it wasn't a short leap for me to look at my mother saying, okay, I have these stories, so I'm going to just write them down and give them to you. To me saying, okay, well, of course I'll be a writer. And I think too, like my dad's side of the family is from Antigua, and he was born, I think, the same year as Jamaica Kincaid. And there's possibly some family connection. We don't know if that's really true or if it's just, you know, island lore. But I felt like Jamaica Kincaid belonged to me because of that family connection that I thought was real, right? Even if it's not real, as a kid thinking like, oh, this was kind of my aunt that was writing this, that was again a way in which I felt like I owned, and I don't mean that in the like capitalist sense of like owning people or things, but yeah. I belonged to a community of writers already. And I think that's an unusual thing for someone like me.
It's amazing to think of how these things create your own sense of possibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for me, I grew up in the town next to Bruce Springsteen, and I had teachers who had taught him. And, you know, it's interesting to think of how that may or may not have of anyone in that area, of not just, you know, if you like someone like that, but if you have that connection, it almost reflects your own potential in some ways too.
Yeah. And it, you know, in the case of, I was just thinking about this because Jackie Woodson just won the MacArthur, and I met her when I was 19. I was an intern at this black arts organization called 651 Arts in Brooklyn. And my supervisor, like her girlfriend, was Jackie's best friend. And she said to me one day, like, do you want to meet Jackie Woodson? She's like a young adult writer. And I was like, I don't know who Jackie Woodson is, but like, of course I want to meet a black woman who's a writer because I've never met one before. So I met her. And I remember, I think she was like getting her hair done on Flatbush Avenue. And something about that, like, made her really regular for me. You know, I was like, oh, she's just like an auntie or a cousin or a friend, except she's doing this thing that most people I know don't do professionally, right? And so meeting Jackie at that young age really like knowing about Bruce Springsteen and having that connection to him through your teachers, I think was for you, like, really made possible this kind of career as a writer. And then, like, I did my paperback launch with Jackie in 2016, which was really cool. I would never have thought that that would have happened. Like, if you had asked me when I was 19, like, oh, will you have a book event with Jackie Woodson like 20 years from now? I'd be like, yeah, right. That's not happening. But she really cemented the possibility of me as a writer. And I think importantly, of not having to become anybody else in order to be a writer. Like, I could just be myself and just telling the stories of myself and the people I cared about. Like, that was enough. There was no pressure to perform.
I mean, that's like the advanced Jedi level stuff. Like, because usually with creating, it's that you can create, that you have permission to create. And then, I mean, that idea that you can be who you are, that you can, that's enough. That always seems like it's something that takes people sometimes a lifetime, but it's not always the first intuitive thing. It's usually, you know, this was after years of trying and copying. Then it's just amazing to hear you describe that, and that kind of coming to you at I'll call a younger age.
Yeah, I think I was incredibly lucky. And I think I have, I think my personality helped, right? So, like, I didn't, I'm the kind of person, if you tell me I can't do something, like, I want to run immediately in the direction of that thing. And so, like, in high school, I don't know why I'm airing this out, but whatever, we're talking about young stuff, the stuff of youth. And, like, I remember not being able to get any of my poems accepted into the literary magazine at my prep school, and, like, feeling really angsty about it. Like, I felt very rejected. And it was this funny thing, because I had this audience of Black girls who loved my poems, right? They would sit in the hallway. This is a Trinity school on the Upper West Side. And they'd be like, all right, Naomi, like, read us one of your poems. And I'd read them, and they'd be like clapping, just giving me, showing me so much love. And so I knew that was what I wanted, that reflection from people who knew what I was talking about. But I also wanted the other thing of being respected enough to be in these magazines. And so I think I learned something in that, like, rejection, that I wanted that, but also that the acceptance was already there with the people who knew me and who knew stories of people like me. So I'm not sure exactly what I want to say with that, but that was a formative part of my experience. Like, I didn't, like, Jackie, for example, tells the experience of, like, you know, winning writing contests when she was a young person. I never won any of those things. Like, I was terrible for a really long time. Like, it was only in my late 20s that I feel like I started to really hit my stride as a writer. It took a long time. So I don't have the story of, like, I was a golden child. Everyone told me I should be a writer. Like, that's not my story. I think my story is more one of, like, grit and just determination to do something because people told me I couldn't do it. And because I loved it, right? Not just out of the desire to make other people look bad, but because it was something that I really believed in for myself.
I mean, that's the kind of story that inspires me so much. I mean, I think it's honestly why I do this podcast. It's that idea of, one, what you said, of doing what you truly are drawn to, what you love or that what have you, but then that sort of persistence, whether it's stamina or endurance, or, you know, that you might feel, I'm not saying this for you, but, like, you know, feel like an outsider in a certain area or a certain, you know, genre or clique or whatever, or go through rejections or whatever that is. And it's like that persistence, and then how it culminates in something later on is sort of what I'm always, the kinds of stories I'm always drawn to, because I think that is the work, like the reality for a lot of people who want to be professional in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I didn't get a chance to say this before, but, like, you know, part of the reason why I said yes when you reached out, even though I'm not really, I'm, like, officially on maternity leave and supposedly not working in this way is because I really appreciated the community that I joined when I was about to have my book come out. Like, there was the Facebook page, and I remember checking in on that a lot, just like throwing around ideas about like marketing and how to grow an audience and thinking about my newsletter at the time. So it was so helpful to be in that community of other writers thinking about the same kinds of things. So I don't know if I've ever had a chance to say thank you, but I want to say thank you to you. But also just say to the people who will listen to this, like, the community of people that you meet along the way is just really important. You never know where you'll end up. Like, I was, as you were talking before about persistence, there's a poet, Nicole Seeley, who came out. She was the director of an African-American poetry organization called Cafe Canem, and Nicole's amazing. But like, when we were in our early 20s, we used to go and eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on at a cafe near Flatbush Avenue, near Atlantic and Flatbush, and just like share poems. And that was one of the ways we grew up as poets together. And now we've both like published our own books and we're like adults. But I'll never forget those early moments. And I think, I guess I just am trying to say that more of life is in the peanut butter and jelly sharing poems moments than it is in the like, oh my God, my New York Times book review. Like, if I think about the length of time I spent writing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, not writing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but eating and writing together with Nicole, that actually took up more space in my early 20s and was more formative in a way than like reacting to book reviews of my first novel, you know?
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. And thank you for the kind words.
Yeah.
So what was it that drew you to poetry first, or was that part of multiple creative things that you were doing?
You know, to be honest, like, I was a pretty angsty teenager, this emotional person. You know, my parents had divorced, and my mother had been like, when I was a teenager, my mother was like not in my life at all. So I had a lot to be, to have feelings about. And I think other teenagers would probably have like written a lot of diary journal entries, but I was just never good at it. Like, I just couldn't keep up with it, but I could keep up with poetry. And it just felt like a really immediate vehicle for the things that I cared about and then I thought about. So like the things I cared about personally. And I think I was also growing into myself politically. This is going to be odd to say, but I do think, like, you know, probably in eighth grade, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And then like the next year, I was one of four Black girls at this very prestigious prep school on the Upper West Side. And so those two things are connected. Like, I felt like I was actually politicized by being in this, suddenly in this minority group. Whereas before, you know, I grew up in Flatbush and Crown Heights, so predominantly Caribbean neighborhoods. And I never questioned that my experience was the center of the universe. Never. It was only when I went to this high school that I was like, oh, white people are important. And I'm actually not joking. Like, I just never, it was a new thing. Like, this idea of racism and white supremacy and feminism. And, you know, I was coming out at the time. Like, all these things were happening and swirling around me. And poetry actually seems like a great vehicle to just talk about all that stuff, right? So you could be like, here's my poem about how I feel about being a Black girl at Trinity. Here's my poem about how I feel about this crush on this girl, even though I could never really say that that's what that was about. But like, it was just a place for me to work through some stuff. And I think for most people, I don't love writing as therapy. Like, I don't believe that most people want to read that, but I do think that that's how most people enter writing, is through some attempt to process the things that have happened to them or the things that they care about. So that was my first love, was poetry. And I actually took poetry workshops up until 2011, so until about 10 years ago. And so I think actually most of the people who knew me in my early 20s would be surprised to know me as a fiction writer now, because they're like, wait, I thought you were a poet. So I did kind of do a switch. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop in 2011, and I decided to focus on fiction. But to be honest, like, all due respect to poets, I actually think poetry is a harder form than fiction or nonfiction. But I just loved it. I just felt like the ability to worry over a word, over an image, over a line. I just love that attention to detail. And I loved the way that you could just talk about so many different things. You know, it just felt very capacious as a form.
So as you were going from high school, you know, thinking about beyond that, were you thinking of all of this as, you know, writing, whether it was poetry or otherwise, as a career? Or were you following like a dual path where now I had to pick this career, but I was still writing on the side, and it took years to get there?
Yeah, I mean, I never declared myself a writer until I had actually like kind of failed at doing other things, to be quite frank. So I was, you know, I went to Williams College, and I was like, very much, I like to kind of tease my students as being like capital S success, you know, like I was very focused on ticking off the boxes and being a high achieving immigrant kid. And so I think at the time I had applied to the Fulbright and I didn't get it. And I was like very upset. I went on to get it like a couple of years after the fact. But I was like very pissed off and just disappointed in myself. Like looking back on it, I'm like, why wasn't it just enough to graduate from Williams? It was like one of the best colleges in the country. There was no reason to be down on myself about that. That was actually a pretty significant accomplishment in and of itself. But again, I was capital success. And so I was disappointed in myself. And then I went, my grandmother actually had a really, this is a rambling story, but my grandmother had a really terrible accident the summer after I graduated from college, and she couldn't walk anymore. For whatever reason, we were actually not particularly close before this, but we became very close. And I would just like go to see her in the hospital almost every day. And at the end of that summer, she was like, girl, what are you doing? Like, you are 21. I think I was 21 or 22 at the time. She's like, you can't spend your whole life in the hospital looking at me. Like, go do something. And so that was when I started like taking dance classes, and I started writing. I went back to the library. The library was really the primary form of my self-education from my early 20s till now, just reading books and thinking through what kinds of books I wanted to be writing. So it was only really at my grandmother's urging to get out of her room and do something that I kind of just started reading. I had like an office job. I worked in philanthropy and in development, so I was a nonprofit professional. And that's not at all to diminish that work. I actually really loved it, especially, you know, my late 20s. I was a program officer at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. So it was fun. I got to, like, travel the country and a little bit of the world, seeing what people were doing in terms of arts and social justice work. And it was just, there's an incredible privilege. I think when you work for the Rockefellers, like anybody will talk to you about basically anything, particularly if you offer to take them out to lunch, right? And so I had a bird's eye view of like civic participation work all around the country, youth organizing work, which was one of the things we were funding. I got to travel to the Pine Ridge Reservation to better understand what was happening in Native youth communities. I traveled to the South. It was a super cool job. And I was just writing on the side, writing and reading on the side always.
Does that give you a different kind of permission to like I think about where I've been doing interviews for, you know, more than a decade. And there's definitely something that unlocked in me at some point. It was actually in the 90s when I had a music fanzine. I just started calling record labels and getting interviews where I realized, oh, I can ask them for an interview, and where they say no, or just, it sounds like that job almost unlocks something where you could call anyone that you wanted to or get access to. Was that a big moment? Because that alone feels like it would be a huge sort of unlock in someone's mind that, like, I can go here, I can go there.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, my brother-in-law jokes about, like, wanting to raise overly entitled Black children. And so I, you know, at first I balked at it, and then I was like, oh, I get what you're trying to say. Because I do think in that moment, though, I would work there for about 5 years, so as long as that job I had ever had. Yeah, there was something really powerful about being able to think, like, oh, I have a question. I wonder who in the world might have the answer to this question. Let me go ask them. Right. And I actually think that that has, I wonder if that has trained me in a way for thinking about writing nonfiction, which I'm doing more of these days. But yeah, I do think it did unlock that privilege, did unlock something for me. And, you know, honestly, I would have still been there. Like, I loved that job. I loved my colleagues. I loved what I was doing. But I was writing more and more and more, and I really wanted to publish my novel. And more importantly, I wanted to finish my novel, like, not to publish. I just was like, you know, I just don't want to be 90 saying, like, I had this debut novel I've been working on, you know, like, I really wanted to get it done. And so I applied to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I think I was like 29. And I was like, it was my third time applying to graduate school. So again, a story about persistence. So I didn't get into any schools the first two times. Actually, if I'm being correct, it's the fourth time. Because first I applied to English PhDs. And then twice I applied to MFA programs in creative writing. And then the third time, I mean, the irony of this also hilariously is, like, I'm teaching at Rutgers Newark, which is one of the MFA programs that did not accept me. So, just fine. It's fine. It's just the irony of life. So anyway, I just was like, okay, I'm going to apply one more time with feeling. And I applied to like 11 programs, and I got into the Iowa Writers Workshop. And I honestly, like, I wanted to go, but I didn't think it was a dream school for me. I didn't think I would get in. And so, you kind of can't make this part of the story up. I got like a $30,000 raise at my job, and that morning, and then that evening I got a call from Sam Chang at the Iowa Writers Workshop saying, like, you've been admitted to the workshop. We'd love to talk to you about coming out. And like, to be honest, I wasn't sure if I was going to do it, if I was going to defer. You know, my revisionist immigrant parents will tell you, like, we always said you should go, but the reality is they were like, are you sure you don't want to defer for a year and save some more money, you know? But I went, I like booked a ticket out to Iowa to check it out, because I was like, I don't know. I mean, like, it seems like it's the best program, but like, what if it isn't? What if I hate Iowa City? Like, I have a nice job. I could like buy a new apartment, like live a nice life in New York. Like, I was giving up a six-figure salary to go make $17,000 and live in the cornfields of Iowa. It was a significant sacrifice to do it. But I just was like, you know, fuck it. Like, there will always be somebody who will pay me to do a job. I have enough professional experience that I can always come back to philanthropy if I'd like to. But I know that this opportunity may not always be here. So I actually asked them about deferring, and they said that wasn't a thing. Like, you can't defer. Like, either you're coming this year or you're going to reapply next year. And I was like, well, given that I've applied three times and this is the first time I've gotten in, I don't think I want to try those out. So I just, you know, I quit my job and I left.
That I just want to pause there, because that feels huge. And especially at that age, because that's sort of the age that in my just experience, when you're in your late 20s and early 30s, you have kind of settled in a job. And like you said, you might be earning okay, or you might just be comfortable. You're in the city that you know, things are going okay. To make that choice to sort of make such a pivot, I feel like is so unusual. I just like details. Like, what was it like giving notice to that job?
They were shocked, right? Because it's like, who? I had fought for my promotion and this money. And so that was like in, I don't know, February? And then July, I gave notice. So those were a tense couple months. I'm not a good liar. So I was like feeling all this pressure, going to work every day, knowing that I was leaving. But I think they were really in shock, because I think also, like, I really had kept my cards close to my chest about my writing because I wanted to be protective of that space. So I wasn't, like, I would kind of talk every once in a while about writing, but I think it was easy enough for people not to take me very seriously. And so when I said, I'm going to the Iowa Writers Workshop, they were like, wait, say what? What are you doing? Okay. I mean, I think most people were shocked. But they were supportive. And, you know, I think happy to see me go off and pursue my dream. And I'm still friends with, like, many of my colleagues from those times. So it was strange. You know, I was reflecting on it recently, and I think about it, and I'm like, yeah, I was doing the opposite of what most people were doing. Like, most people in their early 30s are solidifying their wealth gains and, like, starting families. And whereas I was kind of just giving up all the stability that I'd, you know, accumulated over the years before in pursuit of what? Like, I could just as easily have gone and not finished my novel and not published my novel and not, like, I got lucky. I mean, yes, it is one of the better programs in the country, but there are also many people who I went to school with who haven't published anything. That's just the reality of it. Like, there were 25 people in my class. Maybe 10 of us have books. I don't think people would believe those numbers, but I think I'm probably correct in terms of that. And so, like, writing is an incredibly difficult thing. But what I knew was that if I didn't do something kind of courageous and bold in that moment, I knew I'd always regret it. And I knew that regret, like, I would, that was something I couldn't live with. I could live with disappointment. I could live with failure. I could live with shame. But I couldn't live with, like, the coulda, shoulda, woulda, if I were braver kind of line of thought. And that actually helps, you know, hang out with old people, because you will start to see what regret looks like when you're in your 80s and 90s, actually. So I feel like, in a way, my early 20s hangouts with my grandmother actually helped shift my perspective, because my perspective is somewhat from my generation, but it's also deeply influenced by older people. And I think if you actually really spend time with older people, most of them will tell you they regret the things they didn't do, the relationships they didn't have, the jobs they didn't take, the places they didn't move to. Like, those things are the things that haunt you.
I love that. I love that advice. So you're in Iowa. What's sort of the next step or the next milestone? Was it a straight path from there to my book is finished, whatever, or were there other kind of mini milestones before that?
Yeah, it was not straightforward. I mean, I think I was excited to be there, but I think I was also freaked out. Like, I was before working like anywhere between 40 and 70 hours a week, depending on what a week looked like. I was traveling almost every single week out of New York, you know, South Dakota, DC, Kentucky, wherever. I was traveling a lot. And so to just sit down for an entire semester in Iowa, when I'm also from Brooklyn, was really challenging. And so I spent the first month actually, like, looking for a job. I laugh at that now, but, like, nowhere would hire me. I was like, I'll do anything. You know, like, I failed the test to become a library assistant because I don't know how to alphabetize things and, like, put things in numerical order. Like, I can't actually do that. I don't have that skill. So I applied for, like, every little job on the intranet in Iowa City. And then finally I was like, okay, Naomi, like, maybe you could just sit down and write your book. Like, that's something you could do.
I like how it's, writers write their books when they have exhausted all other possibilities.
Yeah, that is also what this conversation is about. And so I just, I sat down eventually and I started writing. Probably the most pivotal thing was the summer after my first year. I went to Barbados and I was just like, by hook or by crook, I'm going to finish a first draft of this novel. And so I went to BIM. I just like sat down and wrote by hand every single morning for 2 or 3 hours, typed up whatever I'd written every single afternoon. A friend of mine was doing location scouting for a film. So I spent a lot of time with her, like just driving around the island to get a sense of like, because my book is set in Barbados and Brooklyn. So I was just really trying to get a sense of like the texture, the culture, the language of the island. So that was the really pivotal moment. So the big milestone was finishing the first draft, which I did. And I got an agent in December of 2012. Yeah, December of 2012. And then it actually happened all very quickly for me. Like I got the agent in December and then...
What was the agent search like?
I always hesitate to tell my story because it's not helpful. Like I had a friend who worked in publishing. She used to work for Christopher Jackson at One World, who's now at One World. And so she knew a lot of agents, and her and my agent were really good friends. And before I actually even went to Iowa, she had invited her to one of my readings. And I love her. We're now very much friends. And so it's been almost 10 years. And she said to me at that reading, like, if you sign with any other agent, I'm going to shiv them. And so it's just hilarious. Like, it was very OG, like, New York Jewish gangster. And I was like, yes, the, like, girl from Flatbush and B, like, sees you. Like, we're eye to eye on this one. And so I actually had talked to a lot of other agents at Iowa. That's one of the things which I think can be a benefit and kind of a delta of being at Iowa. There are agents who do appointments with students every single week at the workshop. And so that was a pretty grueling process because they make like anywhere between 20 and 40 appointments. You know, you have like a 20-minute slot. And you need to like make the best of the first 5 minutes, really, because it really goes downhill very quickly after that. And so I had agents tell me all kinds of things. Like most of them were like, okay, because I had started the second novel, which I'm now still trying to finish. And so most of them would say like, okay, this coming of age novel set in Barbados and Brooklyn, like two Black girls, who really cares? Tell us more about your real novel, which is the big novel that you're working on now. And so I think I had started to feel like nobody cares about this first novel, which was not true, but that was what a lot of agents were telling me. And so long story short, I talked to lots of agents and I ended up going right back to this person who my friend had introduced me to, mostly because she was young and she was very hungry and she knew what I was trying to do, and she seemed willing to really get in there and work with me. I think she looked at 6 different drafts of my novel before we even sent it to prep, like before we tried to sell it. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that the other agents I was talking to, they were not the ones who liked me, which were few. This is important to say. I think the thing that I want to say is that, like, you actually only really need one person to really like you. And if everybody likes you, that's actually not a good thing. Because I think what you want is one person who really gets you and is a champion of your work. You don't need a whole bunch of people being like, I'm sorry, blowing smoke up your ass and telling you that you're great. Because those are not the people who are going to actually go hard for you. You want one person who's like, okay, I'm committed to you and to your career. And how are we going to make this happen? And so I think agents generally are taking on more editorial work than they had done in the past. And she definitely did that for me. So the reason why I say that that's not helpful is because I think it's much more common that people have to cold query agents and write them. You know, it's not a personal relationship or an introduction. I think that's a pretty rare experience.
Yeah. Where I do think, and you've hit upon this already, but where it's so helpful is a lot of people have a connection to their network and they say, no, I couldn't ask. And they miss opportunities that are right in front of them because they think that it won't count or it's cutting the line or something. And the other thing is the point that you so directly made, which is you're not ignoring someone who believes in you and wants to work with you because you are, well, I want to get someone through this program or someone that works wherever because they have more access. Like you, these are all partners and collaborators and you have to enjoy the process and have someone who will, as you're saying, help you get better and grow. It's such a critical part of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's such a critical, I didn't understand this at the time. Like we ended up selling my book in an exclusive to an editor who's fabulous. Andrea Walker was at Penguin Press at the time. And I think she's at Penguin and Random House. I'm not actually sure what her affiliation is right now. But anyway, Andrea was fabulous, but she left Penguin Press within a couple months after acquiring my book. And so I think I had thought that like I was getting married figuratively to Andrea, but like really my bride is my agent because like no matter what has happened with like different articles and reviews and everything, like she has really been there through thick and thin to shore me up. And I think too, you have to know what kind of person you are. I am someone who needs a lot of support. Like I need to be able to call you and be like, okay, I just read this review and I kind of want to throw up in my mouth. Can we talk about it? Right. And so, but there are a lot of agents who are just like, look, go talk to somebody else in your family about your feelings. Like I'm not here for that. Right. But I knew that I needed somebody who I could have that back and forth with. So anyway. Yeah.
I love that. So you got the agent, you submitted it, you got the exclusive. What was the launch experience like?
It was really intense. Like, I think I did not understand how much this book would overtake my life. Like, it was just months of, like, up till 2 or 3 in the morning every night answering emails and, like, you know, email interviews and scheduling. And it was intense. And also part of this was me. Like I decided that I wanted to, it was very important for me to reach out to Black bookstores and publications and just to do another layer of publicity that my publishing company was like, that's fine, but we're not really equipped to do that. And like, if you want to do that, you need to finance it yourself. And so I did. And so that added an extra layer of stress, I imagine, that wouldn't have been there otherwise. But I don't regret it. Like, I went to the West Coast and did readings in Seattle and LA and Oakland. It was fabulous. Like, I loved it. I've connected with readers who I'm still in touch with. I feel like it was important in terms of building an audience for my next project and for other projects. And that part of it was really fun. Like the most fun part of the launch experience was like the party. We threw this great party at a bookstore in Brooklyn. It was like 175 people came. We sold out the books. My cousins like had a like rum punch assembly line the night before. We had like a photo cake with a picture of the book. That was super fun. That was amazing. And then like all the opportunities that I had along the way to really connect with readers, that was the best part of the experience. I think I thought the things I thought would be super important, like reviews and press and all that, didn't turn out to be. Except, you know, the one thing that was really cool is that I did an event at WNYC and which is the NPR affiliate in New York City. And we'd grown up, like, I don't know why I'm talking so much about public radio and public television and public libraries, but whatever. Apparently, that's the theme of this conversation. My dad loves WNYC. And so, like, that was cool. Like, my dad would call me every time they would say my name on WNYC. And then, like, I did an interview on the Leonard Lopate show before Leonard Lopate, like, unraveled in the trash fire of his misogyny and foolishness and before his show was canceled. This is pre Me Too. So I did that and that was pretty cool. Like those were the coolest moments. Like the time with my family, my friends, connecting with readers, and then like the public radio and the public library stuff. That's been the coolest part of it.
I love that. So that came out in 2015. And as you said, you had sort of also started writing more nonfiction, more articles, essays, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Has that been a pivot for you, or is that just a natural thing where you look back, you're like, I don't know how that happened, but it happened?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to someone. I had another publication reach out to me because I had a pretty fairly big essay come out in Harper's in August of 2020, and so I've had a lot of interest come out of that piece. And someone, so I was having a conversation with a new editor, and we were talking about maybe working together, and she's like, how did you even start writing nonfiction? I was like, well, I published a novel, and everybody was like, do you have essays? And I was like, I don't, but I could have essays. And so I started writing essays really for that. And like, you know, looking back on it, there's some of them that I'm like slightly cringy about. Like, I'm like, did I need to publish everything I was thinking at that moment? Probably not. But there were some pieces that I'm proud of. You know, there was an essay that I wrote about the Orlando massacre in 2016, like I think it came out in 2017. So it was on the year anniversary of the Pulse massacre in Orlando. And then the most recent piece I published in Harper's was about giving birth in the shadow of the Black maternal mortality crisis. And so like, for me, the sweet spot is like where I'm able to write from my personal experience into a public conversation that's of importance. So I'm not like interested in memoir for the sake of memoir. Like, I actually don't think that my life is all that interesting. I think most people's lives are interesting. Like, I don't privilege the things that happen to me over anybody else's life. And so when I'm writing pieces that are memoir, I'm really interested in, you know, what's the value of this piece to people in terms of thinking in a new way about a public thing that has happened. So in the case of, you know, the Black maternal mortality crisis, it's like, as I got pregnant, like, everyone kept repeating these statistics to me, like, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die. And I was just like, I want to write about what it's like to experience yourself as a pregnant person where everybody's telling you you might die in the process of giving birth, right? And so that's kind of the sweet spot. The nonfiction that I feel most proud of writes from personal experience into a broader political and public conversation.
So what's the, it's like a difficult question, but it's like, do you have a challenge of, because you've mentioned you're working on the next book, and then you have these essays, you have, I mean, all that you do in life. How has it been to navigate that? Because I mean, my experience, writers feel this pull where they want to do this thing, but it's maybe a longer, bigger term thing. And then they've got these opportunities or these smaller things. Like, what has that been like to navigate? I don't know whether it's your time or energy or that focus on working on that next book versus these other opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to just be straight up with you. Like, I feel like it's really difficult to be a novelist because for a long time, it looks like you're not doing anything. Like, I think, you know, I started this novel that I'm working on in December of 2011. It's almost December 2020 and I'm not done. And every year I'm like, I'm almost finished, but I'm not finished, clearly. But that's fine. I've actually come to like a place of acceptance about that. And I was about to say like, no, but this time I'm almost, but like, why say that? But anyway, like, I think I found, you know, publishing the occasional short story, although I haven't published a short story in like 8 years, but I find that there's something satisfying in nonfiction in that it can actually get done. Right. So like, I can write, you know, in the case of the Harper's piece, I think the final thing was 4,500 words about, but at one point it was a very bloaty 9,000 word document. And so it was actually a pretty significant endeavor, right? I did 10 interviews. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of articles. And then I wrote most of my personal experience was informed by that research and those interviews. And so I actually really like writing nonfiction because, you know, to be frank, it gives me something to do when there's not much movement on the fiction front. So, like, you know, I had a baby in February and then the pandemic hit. And so I was in the house thinking a lot about having a baby, right? And so it seemed like a good time to write about having a baby. Was it as productive for working on my novel? No, not really. I have started in the last couple months to get back to working on my novel, but nonfiction, it kind of feels like it works a different part of my brain, and it allows me to feel productive as a writer. Like, as much as we want to draw joy from the process of writing, it's really satisfying to actually publish something. It really is. To just have your byline, even if it's not a novel, like, it has felt really good to be able to continue to be in conversation with readers, rather than to wait another redacted years before publishing another novel. I think, though, you know, to be quite frank, it's been hard to see other novelists who I came out with in 2015 already, you know, publishing their next novels. But I think I've tried to, like, talk to myself. I try to talk myself off the curb about that because, you know, I think it's like when I hadn't published a first novel, I was like, I want to be like the people who've published the first novel. And then when I have published the first novel, then I was like, I want to have my second novel out. I'm sure I'll have a next round of those feelings about the third and the fourth if I'm lucky enough to get there. But, like, those feelings are normal. I think the thing I want to say is that the process of constantly having to talk yourself down from these spirals is actually part of the work of being a writer, because it's so easy to see other people and what they have and to envy it, to wish it were yours, to beat up on yourself for, like, not being quick enough or smart enough or whatever enough, fill in the blank, enough. But, like, I really, you know, my stepmother's Jamaican, and there's this Jamaican saying, like, what's for you can't be unfor you. And it's so simple, but I come back to it all the time, because it's really just saying, like, whatever's yours is yours, and whatever's for other people is for them. And it really helps me. I'm not someone who's, like, overcome by envy, but it's real. Like, it's a real, I think, actually, ambition is a healthy thing, and comparison is something that human beings do. But it really doesn't yield much good, you know?
I love that. All right, so we've covered a lot. Is there anything I haven't asked about that you think we should definitely talk about?
Yeah, you know, I was feeling that I wanted to talk about this when you first came, because, you know, since 2015, I mentioned this in the article that I wrote, but I had a very severe mental health crisis in 2018 that really took me out from my writing for about 2 years. So I just couldn't write for the first year. And I wasn't sure I'd lost my job. It was a really difficult period. And so I guess I want to just say that, you know, it's not something, I think it's something that I'm still in the process of figuring out. I'm supposed to be writing an essay about it, but I'm kind of stuck. I'm not stuck. I actually am, like, 7,000 words in and just, like, publishing it. That's the more honest version of it. But I guess I want to say, like, that's not something that I felt comfortable talking about on social media, because I was in the process of first experiencing it and then recovering from it and then figuring out what to do and how to move forward with my life afterwards. But I just want to say, for people who have been waylaid, or it's not even waylaid, it's, like, slowed down or rerouted by personal experiences like health crises or mental health crises, just know that there's still, there's life on the other side of it. I think I want to say that. So I think, you know, it felt, even as I was talking about, like, oh, I see all these other people who have second books out, like, honestly, I'm just happy I'm still here. I'm happy to be healthy and have a family and to be writing again. Like, I feel incredibly lucky for it. And in a way, I feel like having that experience of getting really sick makes me very much appreciate what I have now. Because for a moment, I wasn't sure if I would have that, have all those things. And so I think those experiences, those like peak and valley life experiences, because I think we've talked about both of those within this conversation, all of those things are valuable in terms of shaping the kind of human that you become, in terms of shaping the kinds of writing that you can step up to, in terms of making you more courageous animal, you know. So yeah, I just wanted to say that because I think it's important. I think I'm still like nervous to talk about it, but I feel like it's an important thing because I think it's very easy to read my CV and to think this is not someone who's ever experienced struggle. And maybe because I've experienced the other people have experienced struggle, I won't be able to accomplish these things. And neither one of those things is true. So I just wanted to like pull back the curtain a little bit and talk about that.
Thank you. I love that. Thank you for everything you've shared. It is so inspiring how you talk about the creative process and the journey. So I just appreciate you being here. Thank you.
And thank you for like being so committed to creating space for other people to think about their creativity. I imagine that it's something that you get a lot from too, but I just want to say it's a place of grace and healing for other people to hold that much space for other people to think about their work. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. That is so kind. Yes. You can find Naomi Jackson at naomi-jackson.com, on Instagram at the Naomi Jackson, and over on Facebook. You can find her book, The Star Side of Bird Hill, wherever books are sold. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me on social media at Dan Blank or my blog at wegrowmedia.com. If you enjoyed this episode or any others, please consider leaving a rating over on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening until the end.